Let's go back and finish up this last principle or lesson from King David, because I'd like to show you a comparison here between his son, who, based on my understanding, was his oldest son, a very handsome, good-looking, smart, but carnal young man. This is back in 2 Samuel 13. I wanted to, well, actually, let's go back to 12 here just for a minute. Chapter 12 and verse 12. This is what God said, how he said he was going to deal with David in this regard. He had forgiven him of a sin, but he said, "You did this secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." Back in verse 10, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of this son." Now, God didn't have to cause people to do the wrong thing. It kind of comes naturally. And instead of protecting David from these things, which God had been doing, remember, he gave him peace with all of his surrounding neighbors, and he was with him in everything he did, and in other words, protecting and keeping him from harm. God is basically saying here, well, I'm just going to step back, and not so good things are going to transpire that you'll have to go through because of what you have done, so that you don't forget. Okay, go to chapter 13 then. And it starts out here talking in verse 1 about Absalom, and I'll kind of paraphrase this whole chapter. Now after this, it was so that Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar, and another stepbrother, Amnon, the son of David, loved her by a different mother. So anyway, Amnon, he was just lusting and coveting this lady, this young lady, who was a virgin. And the virgins, the king's daughters, dressed in a special multicolored garments, depicting the fact that they were virgins, and this lady, young lady, was a very beautiful woman. But he just wanted her so badly, but he didn't do what he should have done, and that is, as she even said later, he could have gone to the king to get permission to marry her, but he didn't do that. So he did something underhanded. In the next verses here, it shows that he pretended like he was sick, and he had her come in to take care of him and to give him food. And the bottom line here is that she was resisting because he was making advances, and she was saying, "No, no, don't do this. This is a disgrace. This is wrong. Do not force me." But as it says in verse 14, being stronger than she, he forced her. He raped her is what happened. And then, of course, she was very upset, to say the least, and was screaming and crying. And at that point, then Amnon, because of that reaction and the whole situation, he realized he was in big trouble with his father. He just got rid of, told her to leave, and told the servant, "Get her out of here," locked the door behind her, and she went out and kind of stayed with a relative here. Now I can't see exactly where she went temporarily, but anyway, so Tamar remained in verse 20. Desolate in her brother Absalom's house. So she went back to her brother's house. Eventually, verse 21, King David heard about these things, and he was not happy. So Absalom spoke to his brother Amnon. He didn't speak good or bad. but he hated his stepbrother because he had forced his sister. And we find out later in the chapter that Absalom had already decided that he was going to kill Amnon. First chance he got, but he knew he couldn't do it right away. So after 2 years in verse 23 went by, I want you to see Absalom's attitude. And as we go through here, there is no reference whatsoever, although there is a reference, but I'll explain that he really wasn't looking to God. He just said that. He doesn't look to God. He figures, well, I'm the oldest. I should be the king. I should replace my father. And, I mean, after all, look at me. You know, I'm this great-looking guy, and I'm smart, and I'm cunning, and I've got servants and everything else, and I should be the one taking that job. Well, it came to pass after 2 years that Absalom came up with his plan of how he was going to do his brother in. So he got all the king's sons and invited them to come out to his house. And he wanted Amnon to come along. So he had to get David's permission. And at first David, not being dumb, thought, well, this is probably not a good idea. So he said, well, what do you want him to come for? And so he was kind of holding back. But eventually Absalom in verse 27, urged him so that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. And he wanted David to come too, but David said no. Now Absalom, verse 28, had commanded his servant, saying, watch now, and when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. And do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? I mean, I'm important here. I'm the king's son, the next in line. Be courageous and valiant. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. And then all of the king's, this is in verse 29, all the king's sons arose and they took off. They got on their animals and they ran. Now the word came back to the king that Absalom had killed all of his sons, which wasn't true. And so David was really upset. Then in verse 32, then Jonadab, the son of Shimei, David's brother, answered and said, let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men. All of the king's sons, for only Amnon, verse 32, is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister. I'm going to kill you. I just have to wait for that opportunity. Now, you don't see him seeking God. You don't see him talking to his father about it. He just decided that's what's going to happen. And he waited until he had the opportunity to fulfill his decision. Well, Absalom realized he was in big trouble. And so in verse 34, Absalom took off. And he went to stay with, down in verse 37, he went to stay with the son of another king of Gershur, and probably had mutual friendship with. And in verse 37, and David mourned for his son every day. However, in verse 38, so Absalom fled and went to Gershur and was there 3 years. So he lived over there for 3 years. And King David longed to go to Absalom because eventually in verse 39, he'd been comforted and kind of overcame the loss of his son Amnon because he had now been killed. Well, here's another man that wasn't looking to God. God just stepped back and let all these things unfold, because human nature will do exactly what we're seeing here. And this is what we have to be on the alert for. We don't want to be thinking and figuring all these things out on our own. David figured things out on his own once, and look at all the trouble it caused him. But he learned that lesson, and he looked to God. He was humble, and he did try to serve God in everything that he did. And he wanted to have the right heart, as we read in Psalms 51, and we went over that the other Sabbath. So he was concerned, or so Joab was concerned about that, because the king, in verse 1 of chapter 14, that he perceived the king's heart was concerned about Absalom. In other words, that he was mourning inside, and he wanted to try to help David out, so he came up with a plan. Instead of just going and talking to him, he did another kind of underhanded deal. He got this very wise woman to pretend to be a mourner over losing her son. And once he came up with this idea, well, tell the king that one son fought with the other, killed one of the sons, and now the whole family's mad at me, and they want to do away with everything, and I won't have any progeny whatsoever. And so David, when he heard this, was upset. Of course, he believed what she said at first. And he said, well, if anybody tries to hurt you or do anything, you bring them to me, and I'll deal with it. Over in verse 8. So the woman keeps going on, and then she starts getting into this thing, kind of getting personal with David and kind of intimating some things to him. And because he didn't just fall off the turnip truck, you know, he began to realize, wait a minute, there's something phony going on here. Somebody's trying to tell me something. And so finally David says, down in verse 19, and the king said, okay, now you tell me the truth here. Is the hand of Joab with you in all this? Is he behind this? Is he the one who gave you this idea? And the woman said, well, yeah, that's exactly what happened. And he said, all right, I get the point. So he said, all right, he called Joab in, and verse 21, and he said, all right, I have granted this thing. Go, therefore, and bring back the young man Absalom. Okay, but he said, I'm going to give you a condition, and that is in verse 24, but you let him return to his own house, but do not let him see my face. Because he did not want to show approval to what Absalom had done. It wasn't Absalom's place nor his position to decide to take vengeance, because, of course, God says vengeance is mine, says the Eternal. We all get upset over things that we see in the world and the society and maybe at other people, and we want to take revenge on him. We want to respond, because that's just a natural carnal human response. You want to get back at him. You want to deal with it. Well, that's why David had such respect for Saul, even though Saul was trying to kill him, and for these other kings, because he knew it was none of his business. It was between that person, Saul, and God. It wasn't David's place to take Saul out or to do anything to him. And when God got good and ready, he took care of the problem. But if you step in there and start doing God's job, just like Absalom did, he took all of this in his own hands. He planned it all out. He didn't seek God. There's no indication at all. He figured it all out. He did his underhanded things. Then he had to run. When he ran, now he's sitting over there suffering the results for 3 years and wishing he could come back. David's all upset. Joab tries to fix that situation, but it didn't really fix it. It just gave it, what happened here is, she said, "Don't let him see my face," in verse 24. So Absalom returned to his own house, but he did not see the king's face. Verse 25, this is in chapter 14. "Now in all Israel there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him." And so he utilized all of these things. I mean, he looked in the mirror and said, "Yeah, I'm a pretty good guy. Look at me. I'm the king's son. I'm the firstborn or the oldest, and I'm going to be king." And when he had this big, thick mane of hair, and when he cut his hair at the end of every year because it was heavy on him, I don't know how much 200 shekels is, but I'm sure the reason they have it listed here in verse 26 is because it was pretty heavy. He had a pretty dense head of hair. And verse 27, "And Absalom was Absalom were born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. He named his daughter after his sister, and she was a woman of beautiful appearance." So his offspring were very, very handsome and good-looking. And verse 28, "And Absalom dwelt 2 years in Jerusalem, but did not see the king's face." So this was kind of messing up Absalom's plans here, because he wanted to have the freedom and the blessing from the king to be able to proceed, to develop, and to eventually find himself as king himself. I mean, that's what he saw in his mind for himself. So, verse 29, Absalom says to himself, not to God, he didn't seek God, he didn't ask God to give him wisdom or guidance, or, you know, he didn't seek forgiveness, as you're going to see, at all from David, or from God for what he did. He thought he was right the whole time. Sounds like Saul, you know, when he was confronted with his disobedience to what God said to do. First thing he did was, "But the people, but this, but that," to try to justify, because he thought he was right, and in his eyes he did the right thing. He was a little smarter than God. God hadn't given him the proper details, so he filled in the details for God. But that's not what God said to do. And then the next thing, the prophet sees this. "What is this king doing here?" Oh, well, and he gave some excuse for that. And he didn't really, Saul didn't really acknowledge that he had sinned until he began suffering, until the kingdom or the kingship and God's spirit was removed. And then it was worldly sorrow. Oh, no, now I got to suffer. Oh, I've sinned. And I'm sorry I got caught. You know, Paul talked about that, godly sorrow, worldly sorrow. So Absalom decided, well, it was time for him to make his next move here. And in order to do this, he had to get approval from David so that everybody in the kingdom would realize that he was okay and that he could move around more freely. He didn't have to worry about not running into the king, because he wasn't supposed to see him. So, verse 29, he sent for Joab. Now, Joab wasn't stupid, and he knew that when the king said what he did, he'd done his job in his mind to bring his son back, and he was going to keep an arm's length distance away from that situation. But he sent for Joab to send him to the king so he could get to go before the king and get approval and get accepted again. But Joab wouldn't come. And he sent a second time, and he still wouldn't come. You know, I'm not going over there. You know, I'm not stupid here. This is not a good idea for me to do. That's between you and your father, not me. I've done enough here. So verse 30, so he said to his servants, well, I'll get him to come over here. his field is next to mine, told his servants, start his grain field on fire. That'll get his attention, which he did. Then he started his grain field on fire, and Joab, verse 31, arose and came, well, what are you doing, burning my wheat or grain or whatever it was he was growing, in verse 31. And then Absalom answered and said, look, I send to you saying, come here so that I may send you to the king and say, why have I come from, in other words, exile, Gershur. It would have been better for me to have still been there. Now, look what he says here at the end of verse 32. This is the key here. Now, therefore, let me see the king's face. But if there is any iniquity in me, let him execute me. I'm innocent. I didn't do anything wrong. He just didn't get it. He was doing all of this on his own. And this reveals his real attitude and his real viewpoint. And he had an agenda, and he had a goal. And he was going to do what he had to do to execute or to fulfill that goal. So Joab went to the king and told him. And when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed before his face to the ground before the king. And then the king kissed Absalom. And then Absalom went into high gear. Chapter 15, after this happened, Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now he could be more public, you see. Absalom would rise early. Now look at this next subtle undermining plan. He'd already made his decision that he was going to be king and he was going to do whatever it took to get there. And that included undermining his own father, who obviously he didn't agree with, and he wanted to get that job secured. And there was a very subtle way, and this is exactly the way Satan the devil worked with the angels. You think that he did this in one meeting with the angels to get a third of them to follow? No. It took time. He dropped the poison. Yeah, that's not fair. And, if I were in charge. Well, listen, this is exactly what Satan did. Now, verse 2. Now, Absalom would rise up early. He had a mission. And he'd stand beside the gate. Now, here were all these people that had problems coming in to see the king. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king, in other words, any problem, any dispute, came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, oh, where are you from? And, of course, here's this good-looking guy with all this power and authority, king's son, 50 men running before all these chariots, horses. I mean, it was impressive. And so if the king's son is starting to show you personal attention, that's, you're impressed. You don't realize he's trying to undermine his father. You're already concerned about your problem, and here Absalom, the king's son, is showing you favor. And he said they would call to him and say, what city are you from? Where are you from? And he would say, I'm from so-and-so and such a tribe. And then Absalom would drop the poison. Then Absalom would say to him, look, your case is good and right, but there's no deputy of the king to hear you. Nobody can hear you right away. You're going to have to wait. Moreover, Absalom would then slide this in, that I were made judge in the land. Oh, that I were in charge. And that's what Satan said to the angels. I should be in charge, and everyone who has a suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice, because I'm a good guy. I like everybody, and I'd be fair. Implication, David wasn't. David was too busy. David wasn't interested. David didn't care, which none of which was true. But that was the implication without saying it. And this person was like, oh, yeah, Absalom, maybe. Boy, I wish that were the case. And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, to show him respect because he was the king's son, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. So because he was the oldest and because he was the next in line, people are like, oh, man, he's the future king. That's logical. And so he would put out his hand and he would show him this personal type thing. Now, I've even seen that done by some who are long departed from the church in the past, trying to humanly win over politically a following. It's nothing new. They've been doing it since before man was created. It's called Satan. It's the same old baloney. Same record. Different words. Same music is being played. Same dance. Don't be fooled by it. Believe me, brethren, you have to be on guard. This is the oldest method in the world. It's just a little here and a little there, and it's subtle inferences, and pretty soon it gets people all upset, and it gets people... It works. Satan wouldn't do it if it didn't work. I mean, he managed to do a third of the angels. We just have to be close to God, and his spirit will give us insight, and we have to stick to what we see here in the Bible, the principles, and we'll be able to recognize. See, if people were looking to the principles of the Bible here in this situation, they would have seen right through Absalom. They would say, what are you trying to do here? Undermine your dad? Are you criticizing him? Are you calling him unfair, uncaring? Just like Eve. Are you telling me that my father is a liar? Oh, you won't surely die. Yeah, but God said, if you take of this tree, you're going to die. Oh, that's not true. You won't surely die right now. He lied. And Eve, listen, she didn't see through it. She didn't recognize that he was being lied to and deceived and tricked. Now, if she would have been more tuned to what God said, she would have seen it clearly, and she would have said, now, wait a minute, are you calling God a liar? That's what she should have said. But she didn't. And that's exactly what these people should have been able to recognize. Not everybody got fooled. Two-thirds of the angels didn't get fooled, but a third of them did. They fell for the lie. They fell for the trap. Now, you're going to follow a liar? That's a good idea. That's what Satan was asking the angels to do. I'm a liar. Follow me. Christ said that Satan was... not only the father of a liar, but the father of lies. He began lying. And so what he was asking them to do is, well, I'm a liar. Come and follow me. You can trust me. Just think about that. Your leader is a big, fat liar. You can't believe what he says. And you want to follow that? Put your life and your future in the hands of a big, fat liar? I mean, come on. That's not too smart, is it? But people fall for that. And they fall for it in this world, in this society. Liars. You know, I mean, look at Hitler. You throw enough baloney out there and some of it's going to stick. And they get enough people worked up, we're going to do this. And it's all based on lies. And so Absalom simply used that same principle. But that's, David never even came close to doing anything like that, with the exception when he sinned, when he got away from God. And he had to repent of that, and he paid the penalty. So, in this manner, Absalom acted towards all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So, Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He deceived them. He was Mr. Nice Guy. He stole their hearts. Oh,
that
Absalom, he's a good guy. He ought to be in charge. He ought to be the one. We need to get behind him. We need to get this thing changed here. David's just not treating us very well. No, who told you that? Well, Absalom did. Verse 7. This surprised me. And it came to pass after 40 years. Now, this didn't happen overnight. After 40 years that Absalom said to the king, okay, now let me go. This was part of his plan. When he was ready to move, he wanted to go back to Geshur. Okay? He says, please let me go, he wanted to go to Hebron. And that's where David started out. Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I vowed to the Lord. Now, he didn't vow it to the Lord. He vowed it in front of God in his own mind. I am going to be king. And I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get there. And you see that he was doing whatever he had to do. And he was patient. And he knew that that wasn't going to happen overnight. So he was using his own human nature and his own scheming to eventually get what he wanted. Because, you see, he'd already vowed while he was over there for 3 years and also sitting in the house for a couple more years back in Jerusalem, he made the vow, all right, I'm going to be king and I'm going to do what I have to. This isn't fair. And that's the other basic premise that Satan plays off of. Well, that's not fair. I'll treat you fair. And that's his implication here to these people. David's not treating you fairly. If I were in charge, I would treat you fairly. Can you see the difference in the two viewpoints here? This is what normal human carnality does. It just does what it has to do to get what it wants. That's how humans think. That's what they do. They plan, they scheme. Unless they are founded and grounded on principles of God, which cause people to say, well, that's not the right thing to do. Yes, I see I could go that way, but that's not the right thing to do. Yes, Saul is trying to kill me, and all my men are telling me that I should go kill him first. But that's not the right thing to do. Why? Because he respected God. If he had just left God out of the picture, he would have killed Saul. Or at least he'd have tried to. So he said, let me go into Hebron and pay the vow which I vowed to the Lord. For your servant vowed a vow to himself while I dwelt at Geshur in Syria. See, so when he was back with his son of the other king, his buddy, way back there, when he had to spend 3 years, he said, this is what I'm going to do. So he'd accomplished one thing. He'd killed his brother that he determined to do, and now he was going to do this in Syria. And if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. Well, did the Lord bring him back, or did he bring himself back? Well, God allowed it, and the natural thing took place. And the king said to him, go in peace. So he arose, and he went to Hebron. Well, here's David being Mr. Nice Guy and trusting his son, because he loved his son very much. All fathers and mothers love their children deeply, even though they do stupid things. Have you ever heard when some son does something, you know, murders or does some terrible thing, and the mother is interviewed? Well, down there, he really was a good, I can't believe he, you never hear the mother say, yeah, he's a rotten, no good, low life person, and he deserves to get electrocuted. You don't hear him say that. So that's just the way it is. So David was soft in this area and a little bit blind and trusting, but he didn't really have to worry because God had his back. And he also knew that. So he did the proper peaceful thing and accepted what the person said and didn't try to outsmart him or whatever. Of course, he wasn't dumb either, but he just accepted what, you know, he loved his son, and his son said, I want to go there, and that sounded reasonable. So he said, go in peace. And verse 10, then Absalom sent spies throughout immediately now. He takes off and goes over there. Then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel. Now, he had this network all figured out ahead of time. They'd discussed this. Didn't happen overnight. As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. I'll take over there first. And with Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem who were invited. Again, they thought it was a great privilege to be invited by the king's son, the one who would be the next king. That's, you know, they're thinking that in their mind. It's logical. From Jerusalem who were invited, and they went along innocently. They didn't know what was going on, what Absalom was really doing, and did not know a thing. So then Absalom sent for Ahithophel, David's counselor from his city, and while he was offering sacrifices, and the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. Now Ahithophel was the counselor to David. He had a high position. He was a very wise person, and he was comfortable. He had a nice position, like I said, and probably a very nice home and family and so on. And he began, being a smart guy, he looked around and went, well, looks like Absalom's taken over. I might as well step in there and continue my job with him. So I'll join up with him because it looks like David's out of favor, and I better seek the favor of the new guy so that I continue to live my comfortable life. And a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. So David immediately now recognized what had gone on, what had happened, the undercutting that his son had done to him. And he said in verse 14, we better leave. We better get out of here. We better flee. Otherwise, we're not going to escape from Absalom. So everyone, all the ones that were still loyal to David, at least 600 men, all packed up their belongings, and they all took off. And the king said, there was another man who was a Gittite, and he just arrived in that area, but he was very, very loyal to David. And David's saying, well, why are you staying here? Or why are you coming with me? Why don't you just stay here and make peace with the new guy, you know, with my son? And he said, he recognized that David was the one who God had put there, so he was loyal to him. So anyway, they all went across the river, and they headed out in verse 22. They're still in chapter 15. And they crossed over, and all the country wept with a loud voice as the people crossed over. And the king himself, verse 23, crossed over the brook and Kidron, and all the people crossed over towards the way of the wilderness. Well, there was a man by the name of Zadok also, and all the Levites, and they were bearing the Ark of the Covenant with David and the rest of the men, and they set down the Ark in verse 24, and when they had finished crossing over from the city, and the king said to Zadok and the Levites, he said, carry the Ark of God back into the city. Now, this was David's attitude. I mean, the normal person would not react this way. He would be infuriated. He said, but here's David's attitude in contrast to this very hard, determined attitude to take over that his son had. Carry the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, verse 25, he will bring me back and show me both it and his habitation. But if he says this, and he realized that, you know, I mean, he wasn't any great, in his mind, he realized he wasn't any great person. He was just a human being before God. But if he says thus, I have no delight in you, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. Now, there's a real opposite attitude between David and his son Absalom. Total opposite. The king also said to Zadok the priest, are you not a seer? I want you to go back into the city, and your two sons and the other Levites, and you just stay there. And verse 28, see, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until the word comes from you to inform me. So they had a spy network set up so that he would know what was going on. Therefore, Zadok and the other Levites and so on carried the Ark of God back to the Jerusalem, and they remained there. So then David went up by, verse 30, by the ascent of the Mount of Olives. Interesting, here he is climbing up the Mount of Olives. And wept as he went up. Now, he was, I'm sure, weeping for a number of reasons. Weeping over his own failures. Weeping over the fact that his son had done this. And, of course, he knew that God wasn't going to bless this, regardless of what happened to him. He was just a very sorrowful person. And he said in verse 30, as he went up, and he had his head covered and went barefoot. So he was in a very humble position. And all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went. Then someone told David that Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. Now immediately David realized what was going on there, and he wasn't happy about it. He says, O Lord, I pray, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness, because he realized that he was in it for himself, this guy. Now it happened when David had come to the top of the mountain, verse 32, where he worshiped God. Now I don't see any place about Absalom worshiping God. There's no reference at all. Where he worshiped God, that there was Hushai the Archite coming to meet him with his robe torn and dust on his head. And David said, if you go on with me, then you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I will be your servant, O king, just as I have been your father's servant previously, so I will now also be your servant. Then you may defeat the counsel of Ahithophel for me. And that's in verse 34. So this man was David's friend. And do you not have Zadok, in other words, the other, they're going to support you. They're there to help you if you need it. And the priests and so on. And then in verse 36, indeed they have, they're there with their two sons. And by them, towards the end of verse 36, you shall send me everything you hear. Let me know what's going on. So Hushai, or however it's pronounced, David's friend, went into the city, and Absalom came into Jerusalem. Now, Hushai was David's personal friend, but he was also a wise person and respected. Well, in chapter 16, he was up towards the top of the mountain, and various things happened here. A man came out with this food and so on. I'm going to skip over that. But then in verse 5, now when the king David came to the next city, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul. So he was part of one of the relatives of Saul, and he never did get over the fact that David had become king. So he says, whose name was Shimei and the son of Gera coming from there? And he came out cursing continuously as he came, cursing David. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of the king of David. and all the people and all the mighty men. Now, these mighty men would go out and they would kill 200 and 300 people themselves alone. One guy. You don't want to be throwing stones at the mighty men. I don't think that's a good idea. But, of course, the mighty men wouldn't do anything unless David approved it. He said, all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. They surrounded him. And this guy kept yelling and cursing David. And he says, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil, because you are a bloodthirsty man. This was this man and Saul's family relatives' attitude. Not good. So then the one servant comes to the king in verse 9 and says, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take his head off, which he could have done pretty easily. And the king said, what have, again, look at David's attitude. What have I to do with you, you sons of Israel? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? In other words, why did you try to stop it when God was the one who sent him to curse David? And David said to his friend there and the servants, see, in verse 11, see how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse. Just let him go on, for so the Lord has ordained it, or ordered him. And verse 12, it may be that the Lord will look upon my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for this his cursing this day. Again, this total contrast between his attitude and Absalom. And David and his men, verse 13, went along the road, and this guy just kept following him. He was up kind of on the hillside opposite him, and he cursed as he went, and they threw stones at David, and he kicked dust on him, and dirt and everything else. But David just kept going. Now the king and all the people who were with him became weary. And eventually, of course, this guy gave up. So they refreshed themselves there. Meanwhile, Absalom, verse 15, and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel was with him. So Ahithophel was still maintaining his job and his position. So it was when David's friend came to Absalom, that he said to Absalom, long live the king, long live the king. In verse 17, Absalom said, is this your loyalty to your friend? Why did you not go with your friend? Why didn't you stay with David? And David's friend said to Absalom in verse 18, no, but whom the Lord and the people and all the men of Israel choose. And this is an interesting statement. But to whom the Lord and this people and all the men of Israel choose, his I will be, and with him I will remain. That's an interesting statement if you think about it. Who did the Lord choose? It wasn't Absalom. So he was kind of saying something interesting there. Furthermore, whom should I serve? Should I, verse 19, not serve in the presence of his son? As I have served your father's presence, so will I be in your presence. But he was really serving David. Then Absalom said to Ahithophel, tell me what I should do. So Ahithophel gave some very, very good advice. And here it's fulfilled what God said was going to happen to David. He said, put up a tent in the top of the house, and go into all your father's concubines in the sight of all Israel, exactly the way God said was going to happen. verse 23, in the counsel of Ahithophel, now listen, this is very interesting, which he gave in those days was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. So everything that this man said was right and wise. However, verse 17 or chapter 17, moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, now let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and weak and make him afraid. And all the people who are with him will flee, and I will strike only the king. So this guy had a lot of power, and this is what he was recommending. I'll go in there, and I'll only kill the king. Then I will bring back all the people to you, and when all they return, except for the man whom you seek, in other words, David, then all the people will be at peace. So you'll be the winner. And that probably would have worked. However, in this saying pleased Absalom, but then he called Hushai back, David's friend. He said, I want to hear what you have to say. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom spoke to him, and he said, Ahithophel said, do so-and-so, and I want to know what you have to say. In verse 7, Hushai said to Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. Not good for what? Not good for David. It wasn't good. It was something that he could see David would be hurt a great deal by or killed. So he said, you know your father in verse 8 and his men, they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds. Now that wasn't really accurate. Well, the men were enraged, but David was, you know, in a different viewpoint. And they were enraged in their minds like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is a man of war, and he will not camp with the people. Surely by now he is hidden in some pit or in some other place. And it will be, verse 9, when some of them are overthrown at first, that whoever hears it will say there is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. In other words, when they start to attack and these mighty men turn and begin killing some of your people off, the word will get out and everybody will be afraid because they know these mighty men. And verse 10, and even he who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, verse 10, will melt completely. For all the Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba like the sand that is by the sea for the multitude, and that you go to battle in person, which was not good advice. It was good advice for David, but not for him. So we will come upon him in some place where he may be found, verse 12, and we will fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all of the men who are with him, there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he, verse 13, has withdrawn into the city, then all Israel shall bring ropes to that city, and we will pull it into the river until there is not one small stone found there. So Absalom, and he thought about this, and all the men of Israel said, well, the counsel of Hushai is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Oh, that's not good news for Ahithophel. For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good counsel. See, the Lord had purposed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent, this is verse 14, that the Lord might bring disaster upon Absalom. Now, David wasn't doing it. God was doing it. Of course, Absalom didn't know this. And Ahithophel realized that the game was up for him. So Hushai said to Zodak, the priest, and so on, they sent these people out secretly to tell David, do not spend the night, verse 16, in the plains and in the wilderness, but speedily cross over, lest the king and all the people who are with him swallow you up. And then, verse 17, these two men were trying to, or they tells a story of how they snuck out and were able to hide in this well and so on. And this woman helped hide them, and but anyway, they got away. And in verse 21, now it came to pass after they had departed that they came up out of the well and went, told King David, and said to David, arise and cross over the water quickly, for thus has Ahithophel counseled against you. So David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed over the Jordan by the morning light. Not one of them was left who had not gone over the Jordan. Now look what Ahithophel did to himself here. He realized that the rope had come to an end for him, because now he knew he'd lost favor. He was smart enough to realize he'd lost favor with Absalom. That thing was going to fall down. He'd already broken his loyalty to David, and he knew he couldn't go back there. So he saddled up his donkey, and he arose and went home to his house and to his city. Then he put his household in order, and he hanged himself. No sense in continuing anymore. Get my house in order, take care of the family. And he died, and he was buried in his father's tomb. And then David went, and again, you can see he was playing the maneuvering game, too, to take care of himself. Not trusting God, but looking to himself. Then David went to the next town. Absalom crossed over the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom made this Amasa captain instead of Joab, of course, who was still with David. And they got all together, and they were ready to go to war. And chapter 18, David numbered the people, and he put Joab and Joab's brother and this other man that had just joined him, who was very loyal, in charge of each one, in charge of one-third of the army. And then towards the end of verse 2 in chapter 18, he said, I will also surely go out with you myself. And the people said, no. We don't want you to risk your life. So he said, you just stay back here. So verse 4, so the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. Now the king had commanded Joab and his other leaders, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom, because he knew these guys, as was mentioned previously, these men were men of war. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captain's orders concerning Absalom. So everyone knew that David wanted them to be gentle with this guy, because he still loved us. It was his son. So the people went out into the field of battle against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. And the people of Israel, verse 7, were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 men took place there that day. So not only did, as we'll see, Absalom die, but 20,000 people had to suffer for following a liar. For the battle was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods destroyed, verse 8, more people that day than the sword devoured, because of the thickness and the brush and, you know, who knows, riding horses and getting slammed into trees and doing all the things that they have to do in battle. And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode on a mule. Now, just picture this. Here's Absalom. He's riding along on this mule, and he meets David's servants. The mule, he's trying to maneuver, and the mule goes underneath the thick boughs of a great tree, and his head, his hair, caught in the tree. This is verse 9, so that he was left hanging beneath the heaven and the earth, interestingly put. And the mule, which was under him, kept going. So he's hanging there by his hair. Now just think about that. First of all, it hurt. That was number one problem. Number two, how do you untangle your hair from this thing? You're hanging there. You have nothing under your feet. You're just there. And here's your enemy. surrounding you. Now a certain man saw it, and he told it Joab. Boy, Joab took off. He said, I saw Absalom hanging from this tree. And Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him? And why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels and silver and a belt. And the man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and the other generals, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. I'm not touching him. You touch him. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life. For there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. Then Joab said, I cannot linger with you. I don't have time to talk to you about this. And he took 3 spears in his hand, and he thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the tree. Then 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him. So that wasn't a too pleasant way to die. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab held back the people. And they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. Then all Israel fled, everyone to his own tent. And they all knew this was not good. David wasn't going to be very happy. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, verse 18, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. Then he called the pillar, and we don't know what happened to his sons. He called the pillar after his own name, and to this day it is called Absalom's Mount. So all these things transpired, and they sent these runners. And we can skip way over here towards the end of the chapter. The king is standing there at the gate, and he gets the report that he sees a runner coming. And he thought, oh, well, this is maybe good news. And then another runner was coming. And then David began to realize in verse 32, and the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord, the king, and all who rise against you to do you harm be as that young man is. And then the king was deeply moved, and he went up to the chamber over the gate, and he wept. Now this is his son, and he was probably thinking he would be the next king, but you know, he could see that this man had done. I mean, how could he do all this? This was just really, really upset David. How could he do this to his own family, his own father, try to undercut, undermine, and now he's dead? And as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place, Absalom, my son. He was not very happy. And so, understandably, but if you are a father, you understand exactly how he felt. You just wish it could have been a different way. If I could have only changed that. He had all this potential. He was, he could lead. He could do this, and you would think that that would be the way it would work out. At least you hope that it would work out that way, but it didn't. And you can see the contrast of these two men from the same family. For whatever reasons, one had learned to trust God and was humble and put it in God's hands, which God did take care of. And anybody who thinks that they're going to overthrow the person who God put in looked like he was being successful for a while until he was hanging by his hair in the tree. That wasn't so good. And it looked like he was winning. It looked like his plan had worked out just fine. Only problem was it wasn't God's plan. It was his plan. And God simply intervened and stopped it, because God's the one who's in charge. He is our Father. And in this case, as we heard in the sermonette, God watches over us, and he looks out for us, and he's the one who's really in charge. And he promises to be our support. So I hope that that helps us in our self-evaluation here over this next week.